Where'd you find this?
Hello, Craig.
Craig's here.
It's Friday, baby.
It is ladies' night.
How about that shitty debate last night? Oh my God, we don't have to.
I did not partake because I'm already on the teetering edge of mental stability every day of my life, and partaking in that would have definitely pushed me off the edge where I might not have been on the episode today.
I just had to get that off my chest. That's all.
Hey man, you got to talk your shit. Everybody was subjected to it. So
I did not have a good time. I was really hoping for one of those. I was really hoping that I could set myself up for one of those afterbirth abortions that Trump kept talking about.
Well, it was crazy too, because like, you know, CNN did a really good job, you know, doing what they did with it and making it fair. But like immediately after the debate was over, they just kept going into like, oh my God, guys, this is done. We need someone new. I was like shocked that CNN wasn't just like, you know, giving Biden a blowjob the whole time. You know, they were literally like, we need a call to action, or we need someone else.
Dude, he's 108. His dick don't work no more.
It totally fits the narrative too. Why else would they do a debate this early? You know.
Well, was it Van Jefferson, Van Jones that was crying afterwards? Was like, I love this man, but he needs to hang it up. And
dude,
like,
listen, I know a lot of people have love for their grandparents, right? Like, Tony, I know your grandpa was like your dude, right? But like, unless like you're blood related or that person raised you, idolizing fucking crypt keepers is the weirdest thing to me. What are you doing? This is a 95 year old man. He has no idea you exist. Who gives a shit?
Yeah, all the one of the analysts was like, man, what a shame on this guy's family. He should just be chilling on a porch somewhere in a rocking chair, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's just, and now he's forced to run for president.
What I'll say though, like the whole like felony argument bullshit, is one felon is cooler than the other. 34 felons does not outweigh the fact that sex workers like another felon, right? That is true. Much cooler of having a criminal arc in your life of sex workers and smoking crack.
Yeah, that's much cooler. All
right, so they talked about the golf thing. Just put it on 18 holes, and we'll just call it there. I don't want to do 5 more months of this shit. Whoever wins, wins. I don't care.
Oh yeah.
Ryan, tell us our betting lines, and we could all make money off of this too. So we'll put that on a later episode.
I'll give you plus 600 odds that he can't hit it 50 yards or more.
All right. So we got team previews. We've got the Falcons, the Bucks, the Titans, but we're going to start with some bits. So Ryan, why don't you take it away?
All right, guys. We are going to profile this week. As you all know, I'm doing Tampa Bay. So we're going to profile one of the best running and receiving, well, not receiving, but he was a double threat. One of the best runners in Tampa Bay's history, and also considered one of the best fullbacks of all time.
Yes. I know. Yes. Because for a minute I was like, what if it's Warrick Dunn? But you said fullback.
I thought about doing work done, but I was like, let's do a runner. Let's do some rushing. So let's talk a little bit about Mike Allstott. All right.
Let's go.
Not only is he one of the greatest fullbacks in NFL history, he's also a local boy, Tony. He's from Plainfield, Joliet area.
That makes sense.
South suburbs.
A lot of corn out there.
He was actually lucky when he was younger, because his father happened to be the athletic director of the Plainfield Junior Cats, which was like a youth football league. You know how like we have the Huntley Raiders around here and stuff.
Excuse me, the Lake in the Hills Falcons. This is a Lake in the Hills Falcons household.
Allstott started playing at the age of like 7 years old, and people started noticing that he, you know, was a pretty special player. So he ended up going to Joliet Catholic Academy, who we all know is, you know, one of the greatest, you know, high schools. They've got like 6 or 7 state titles.
Yeah, they're a big deal.
Yeah, right. Let's see. By the end of his sophomore season, Allstott was promoted to the varsity squad at Joliet Catholic, and he was so dominant that as a sophomore, his team's offensive game plan was real simple. Just get him the ball.
Ta-da.
Yep.
You know, it's funny though, because like that was then the plan when he went to college and then when he went to the pros. Just give him the ball.
The guy that was the sophomore coach actually like said, like, you don't always like to hear that as a varsity coach, but he was that fucking good. And we just decided our game plan would be give him the ball.
Yeah.
Once he was a junior, Allstott put his imprint on Joliet Catholic's presence and legacy. He rushed for over 1,000 yards that season, and his team went undefeated and won the Class 4A title.
Sounds about right.
Yep. As part of his training regimen, he dragged tires around his yard. He got one of his friends, like, had a Volkswagen Beetle, and he would just push that around in the school's parking lot. he also stepped up weight training to the point where, get this, Tony, he was benching 330 pounds when he was 20 years old.
20?
Yeah, this was his junior year of high school.
He was 20 in high school?
Sorry, 16. In Joliet Catholic's first game of the new season, so yeah, this would be his junior season, Allstott was 6'1" and weighed 210 pounds.
Woo!
He's so good, he helped wipe out a 24-6 deficit with under 6 minutes left in the fourth quarter, then added two scores in overtime to help them defeat Mount Carmel, who we all know is another really good.
Yeah.
Who was the guy from Northern? Was it PJ Fleck or no? It was another different guy that went to Mount Carmel.
Dude, I can't remember. So many people went to Mount Carmel.
Right. So get this, on the season, Allstott had 2,051 rushing yards on 271 carries. So what, that's like a 9 yard average, right?
Insane.
Also, he had 29 touchdowns.
Wow.
And Joliet Catholic still lost in the semifinals. And this is what got like a lot of Big Ten schools to like start looking at him. So eventually he ended up at Purdue University, which was good because he's a family guy and, you know, he'd be close to home because, you know, Lafayette's only like, what, an hour and a half away from the south suburbs.
Yeah.
Maybe like 2.5 hours from where we are. He didn't get too much playing time as a freshman, but the following year he started to like impress the coaches and stuff. And his sophomore season, he rushed for 816 yards and scored 12 touchdowns. Yeah, his sophomore season in 93. He also added 407 receiving yards and 2 receiving touchdowns. The coaches really started to like his work ethic. He rushed over 1,000 yards in his junior season with 14 touchdowns and 300 yards in the air. He ended his season, or his 1996 senior season was his best in terms of rushing. He had over 1,400 yards, only 11 touchdowns, though. And at that point, I think the record has been broken since then, but at that point, no one had ever rushed for more yards in a single season in Purdue history.
Wow.
I don't know if that record still stands today, but it stood when he graduated. Naturally, he went on to get drafted by the Bucks in 96, 35th overall pick in the second round. And it turned out to be a great value because he might as well have just went first or second overall.
He had a great
playing career with Tampa Bay. He tore it up like when they played the Vikings. Like he was, I think like every game he played the Vikings, he averaged over 100 yards. just rushing. That's not including receiving yards.
As a fullback. Yeah.
Right. Because he was like playing tandem with
Work Done.
Work Done. So for his career too. So that was like a freaking awesome like 1-2 punch, like probably one of the best 1-2 punches that the NFL will ever see. Had some like neck problems later on in his career, which ultimately forced him into retirement in 2008. But when he first went to Tampa, like shit was like bad. Like Tampa was a team that their inaugural season was in 76. And like Shane, I don't know if you know this, but they lost their first 26 games in a row.
Like, how does that happen? Like You can't win one.
We talked about it a little bit when I did the expansion draft segment. They had to reorient the rules for expansion drafts to give the expansion teams a better chance, because like when they did that expansion, each team only had to submit like 10 players to potentially be drafted, and it was like everyone picked their 10 oldest and worst players.
Yeah, you can have this 45-year-old.
Yeah.
You can have Darren Waller, Jason Kelsey.
Right.
So eventually, you know, he played good his entire years, but Tampa didn't end up winning the Super Bowl until 2002. And that was actually played in San Diego at the Chargers old stadium.
Shout out.
He did have the first Super Bowl touchdown in Buccaneers history as well. He had more receiving yards than he had rushing yards. He only rushed for 15 yards, but that's because Bork Dunn was mainly handling it. But he had 43 receiving yards, and Bucks ended up winning in 2002. Alsatt in his career has over 1,300 rushing attempts, a little over 5,000 rushing yards. He had 2,284 receiving yards. He had 58 touchdowns on the ground and 13 receiving touchdowns. He remained the Buccaneers' all-time leading touchdown scorer until November 22nd, 2021, when, can you guys guess who,
broke it? It's Rashad White. No, it's Mike Evans, baby.
So Mike Evans got his 72nd career TD as a Buccaneer and broke the record. So that stood for 13 years, something like that.
Kate Otten's next.
Yes.
He's been to the Pro Bowl a bunch of times. He was also playing on Bucks when they had like a really good defense as well. Let's see, in 2002, the year they went to the Super Bowl, opposing quarterbacks playing against the Bucks were held to a 48.4 passer rating that year.
That was a Rich Gannon year, right?
Yes.
I want to say that was the year after Dungy was fired and they hired Gruden, right?
Well, for the Raiders. With Tony Siragusa landing on the quarterback, right? Oh, no, that was the year before. Yeah, that was Rich Gannon, and that was the year that the center just didn't show up to play in the Super Bowl.
Which we covered.
Right.
We sure did.
I do remember that Super Bowl, though, because I was like one of the first ones, and my grandpa had a big old fucking plate of food on a paper plate, and he loaded up so much he just folded in half and spilled all over his shirt. So after that, the rule is we got to buy the thickest paper plates for my grandpa, and he's got to double them up.
See, Joe Biden.
That Super Bowl too was one of the highest scoring ones too. I mean we could probably go back and watch it on NFL films, but the final score was 48-21.
Well, there was like they were up a bunch, and then they had like back to back pick sixes.
Oh yeah, yeah. Mike Alstott to this day does a bunch of charity work as quality football players himself has, you know, should. I didn't see too much dirt about this guy. Like, I don't think he's been arrested for DUI or anything crazy like that. Does a lot of charity work for sick kids, which I thought was really cool. He does a lot of stuff with the Ronald McDonald House. And he helps serve Thanksgiving meals to people in Tampa Bay area. All his kids, he still lives down there and stuff.
Didn't like Plainfield.
Yeah, right. Well, that's where he became famous.
Some people don't like the snow, all right?
He didn't like the taxes. Him and his kids, they visit the Children's Hospital in Tampa every year and bring them stuffed animals and dress up in like super silly outfits and just give the kids a nice good time. And
dope.
I think that's really cool that when guys like that give back to the kids, because who was the singer that said, "I believe our children are the future," or was that Eddie Murphy? No. But yes, anyone that can do charity work for the children, great accomplishment. Once again, Super Bowl champ Mike Alstott, probably the best fullback ever in the game.
In the modern era, for sure. I was going to say earlier, Shane, if you haven't seen this dude run, watch videos, because it's like watching people try to tackle a refrigerator.
Well, he's that's so just big. Like the fullback, right? Like, we need, like, bring back fat boy running backs, right? Like,
but I like
know we got, like, A.J. Dillon, but, like...
Imagine if like Blake Corum was
human sized,
bigger, like 6'1", 250 instead of 5'8", 215.
Did he run with the neck pad?
Oh yeah, you bet your ass ran with the neck pad.
He was one of those dudes. It was so intimidating. Like, to imagine being on the defense and watching that guy. Like, I'm sure that one at some points, you know, those guys were putting Alka-Seltzer in their mouths, watching them foam at the mouth. Like, holy fuck, I gotta block this guy.
Nobody look this up, because if it's not true, I don't care. I want to live with it in my peace. We had Bears tickets growing up, and like, I remember, I think it was rookie Lance Briggs on like a 4th-and-1 tackled Mike Allstott on like a dump off pass where there was like no one within 10 yards either way to seal the game. And it was like the coolest moment of my childhood. And then I went home when I didn't have any friends. But, you know,
hey, that was pretty sick. We're here now, all right?
We did it. All right, Mike Allstott. I got a runner today, too.
Hell yeah.
So we're going to switch it up. I have kind of a new segment idea or a new way to work in our bits. And you guys are free to use this type of format if you want. I think you might like it. It's going to be fun. So today we're going to talk about Titans legend Eddie George.
Oh, dude. Ooh, Survivor legend.
Yeah. His wife was on Survivor?
Yes, he was also on the show. We'll talk about that when we get to that. This is how I can contribute.
Wait, how do I not know this?
Do it now. I want to hear it now, if you can.
Yeah, so his wife was on Survivor, and one of the rewards was, like, you could have a family member with you if you won the challenge. So Eddie George just showed up and everyone's like, holy fuck, that's Eddie George. So he ended up like going to this, like, it's Survivor, right? So it's like a little telegraphed of like, they're not completely in peril, but like they're in the desert. They're miserable. Right. And bro, this guy just rips off her fucking socks and just starts giving her a foot rub in the middle of the desert by themselves. And I was like, that's a real husband, dude. And then she was on like two other seasons, and I think he was on like one or two. I've never seen those seasons, but I know he like showed up again.
Recurring?
Yeah, because he was like really good at the game.
Oh, man. Okay, so Eddie George, confirmed wife guy.
Yeah.
Confirmed. Okay, so born in Philadelphia in 1973, plays college ball at Ohio State, wins the Heisman in 95 because he's really good. He gets drafted in the first round of the 96 draft. The then Houston Oilers were trying to get Jerome Bettis from the Rams, but Bettis chose the Steelers, so the Rams took friend of the pod and future murderer Lawrence Phillips in the first round, and then Eddie George went to Houston.
Okay.
He's won a billion awards, and he's been a semifinalist for the Hall of Fame for years now. His jersey number's retired in Tennessee, so we're going to do a tiny bit of stat porn. He played 141 games. He ran the ball 2,865 times.
Oh, my God.
Damn. That's more than Allstott, I think. What was Allstott's? Allstott only had 1,350.
Yeah, exactly. He had 10,441 rushing yards, 68 rushing touchdowns. Did not miss a game in his first 8 seasons.
Damn.
He averaged over 300 attempts a year. In the year 2000, he had 403 carries.
What the hell? Did they just not have a running back?
That was all they did. The real reason we're here, however, is to talk about his post-football life. Sure, he's a 15-win and 18-loss head coach at Tennessee State. Like, you know what? That's fine. Good for you. But he is the owner and proprietor of 3 locations of Eddie George's Grill 27.
Oh, hell yeah.
He's got one on Ohio State's campus. He's got one in some city in Ohio, and then he's got one in the airport.
I gotta look up this restaurant.
Well, I thought I'd spend my time today reading aloud 6 of my favorite reviews of Eddie George's Grill 27 for our enjoyment. So we're going to start with a review from W.R. Kirk from December of last year. Quote, worst service ever. I would go so far as to say the staff is borderline incompetent. They seem to just walk around aimlessly. They made me cash out so they could go on break. Not even close to being worth the price.
Oh my God.
Dude, respect to those workers.
You're going to notice some recurring themes here. All right, so here's Jeff C. Quote, they attempted to bill me again after they already charged me for someone else's order that happened to be identical to mine. The bartender refused to bring me the paper check I requested and said I could scan a QR code to pay, then brought me back from my gate as we were boarding to say the payment didn't go through. I showed her on my Chase app that the charges went through. This is a scam they pull because they know you'll be in a rush to get back to your gate and may pay extra to resolve the issue and make your flight. I wonder how many others were scammed by this place. Find somewhere else for dinner and drinks. I can see why they closed their other location and have poor reviews in Nashville as well. Rip off.
Here's the thing. Just leave.
Yeah, just walk away.
Just walk away. Just get on your airplane. What the fuck are they going to do? Put the plane down?
Yep. All right. Brickyard posted this one. This is a good one. Quote, this has less to do with the food, which is always great, and more the employees. I walked up to the to-go counter at 7:25 this morning for a bottle of water. I was friendly and smiled as I politely paid, but the two women behind the counter carried on a conversation about how they wished this was self-service so they wouldn't have to bother with a paying customer. As nicely as possible, I noted, but if there was self-service, you wouldn't have a job. They laughed, and one said, that's the point, ma'am.
Oh, God.
I guess they don't need to pay rent like everyone else. This location of Eddie George's would be better off without these two representing them at the cashier station. End quote. Let's see. Okay. Okay. Three more. Lola M. Quote, I had a 2-hour layover and stopped by. Well, I ended up leaving. My waiter was completely uninterested and helpless. I was interested in the tacos, but wanted to know first how many were included in the order. Well, she said 2 to 4. I asked her to please double check, and apparently the order comes with 3 tacos. So technically, I mean, she's correct.
She's not lying to you.
Right. I proceed then to order and ask if I could choose different options for each taco, and without knowing, she said right away that it was not possible. I asked her to please double check with the kitchen, which she didn't. I gave up and then ordered the pulled pork tacos, and after waiting 10 minutes, she came and said they were out. At that point, I left.
So I'm looking at the menu, right?
Okay.
And I noticed that, like, it's a really weird business model. It says that they're open from 4:45 a.m. until 7 p.m. They have, like, a breakfast menu, too.
What's the airport, right?
Oh, okay, it's the airport. That makes a lot of sense now. Because I'm like, yeah. What kind of idiot? I'm like, okay, it makes way more sense now.
So they have an airport location, one in just a regular city, and then one on the campus of Ohio State.
I mean, all the stuff I'm looking at looks pretty good, but
yeah, well,
we gotta go. This is like dark tourism. We just gotta go to the Eddie George Airport restaurant.
Yeah, what airport is this outside of Columbus or where
yeah.
is this outside
of? Yeah, Columbus okay. Airport. Okay. All right, so I got two more. One's from Foursquare, which is something I haven't thought about in a while. All right, I'm just gonna read this to you, and I'm gonna add the punctuation in because yeah. Oh, to be a man in this spot during football season! !! The bathroom.
Oh my god.
The end.
They got like a glory hole in there or what?
who knows? The last one though, from Susan M in 2017, quote, I got food poisoning from eating here and had to spend half of a Bon Jovi concert sick in the bathroom.
Well,
I mean, all right. You'd probably be doing that anyway at a Bon Jovi concert.
But... you might deserve it.
And that is Eddie George's 27 Bar and Grill.
Damn.
So there you go.
We gotta go, dude. Like, I have a problem with reviews, right? Because, like, how many times do you get a 3 out of 5 star rating on a product, right? Very few and far between. It's either right. I love this product, I was paid to write this product review, or, dude, I want this place to burn to the ground. Right. There's no in between. There's no reasonable reviews, right?
Right. And so I'm thinking about, like, for future Guys of the Week, I'm gonna start
seeing restaurants.
Any of them have restaurants. Also, to circle back to tie it all in, because Shane, you're going to set the shit off in a minute. Let me just tie this into Ryan's story briefly. You know who has his own restaurant and is a graduate of Mount Carmel High School? Chris Chelios.
Oh, yeah, he does. That's right.
Chelios is a good name for a restaurant.
Dude, I lived right next to a Chelios. Ryan, remember? We went there once for food.
Yeah, in Aurora. We went there one time.
Yeah, it was mid. It was fine.
It was all right. I mean, it wasn't great.
It was 3 out of 5.
The bar.
It's fine. Mid is fine.
Service was, but we also went in like the middle of the day.
Yeah, for lunch.
Clock lunch.
Yeah, the
all the regulars were there and shit.
We had to like throw away the rice. Like the soup, the rice soup was like really gross. Anyways, such is life. All right, so
rice soup. What the? What are you talking about?
Welcome to the Midwest, bro.
I think it was like a probably like a chicken cream of wild rice or something.
Okay, yeah. Okay, that makes sense, and I get you. All right.
Yeah. So let's talk a little Falcons because you're abstaining from your bid.
I do not have a guy because I'm gonna yap. I wrote 9 pages on this team. I don't know why. This is the most I've ever covered on a team. I know I went in sicko mode last year on the Falcons and the Colts, but dog, I am enthralled with this team. And I know you got a lot to say too, Tony, so we're going to have an open dialogue like we always do, but here we are. We're at the Falcons. It's make or break for this franchise and probably the hardest team I'll cover all offseason. I'm going with ceiling, so I don't look like a fool for fading this team like I did the Rams. I still got Catholic guilt on this shit. I'm not going to let it go. I'm sorry. But I do want to die like Icarus on this experience. So we're going to start off with a quote before we go off the deep end. So what if instead of the Atlanta Falcons, it was the Atlanta Freakins, and instead of playing football with Cousins, Michael was playing with his cousin's penis?
What?
Is that Shakespeare?
No, that was my tweet.
So
that was free. The first one's free.
That was Dickens, I think.
Yeah. So we're going to start off the rip with who they lost so we can start this rebuild from the ground up. Notorious Nepo baby and generational idiot Arthur Smith is finally out of Atlanta. So that's already a net positive, even given the unknown. The Falcons had a significant teardown of talent where they basically let every old person that isn't on the O-line walk while trading perennial garbage Desmond Ridder to the Cardinals. So bird for bird.
Yep.
Jonnu's gone. CPAT's gone. Mac Hollins gone. Van Jefferson gone. And a lot of fillers on defense and depth. So they acquired the following. 36-year-old coming off a torn ACL, Kirk Cousins for $90 million guaranteed on essentially a 2-year contract.
Let's go.
Ray McLeod. They traded for Rondale Moore. They signed Darnell Mooney with a whole bunch of younger defense and depth spots just to do a gap year. So we'll break down the draft. Before we talk about the draft, I want to break down the recovery time for Achilles injuries to give context on what happened and why they drafted Michael Penix at pick 8 overall. So shout out to our benevolent leader for sneaking this in on the Twitter feed and inspiring me, Jeff Crisco. So from a study called Performance and Return to Sport After Achilles Tendon Repair in the NFL Players by the authors of Jack, I'm going to butcher all these names.
Good.
So Chonky, Gardner, McCulloch, Lintner, Cosquela, Varner, and Harris. In 2017, they determined within a sample size of 95 NFL players with over 98 total surgeries that 78 players were able to return to the NFL playing at a professional level within 340 days, plus or minus 84.8 days, which is a gigantic time gap, right? That's 3 months.
Sure.
And players that did not have an Achilles tendon repair had significantly longer NFL careers. Duh. They Shocking. Also discovered that there was no significant difference in games per season compared to those without a repair. So you're not going to be missing time with an Achilles tendon for the amount of games you're going to play in a season.
Sure.
Within running back, the main sample size was running back and linebackers. There was a significant performance drop off compared to the preoperative number. So they measured before injury and after injury. This all seems really obvious, right? So granted, running backs and linebackers do play a different type of game than statue quarterbacks, where cutting and explosiveness is important, but that Achilles is still used within the throwing motion and even within statuesque quarterbacks. So week one of the NFL season would be day 315 from Kirk Cousins' initial Achilles injury, so which falls in on the lower threshold of recovery time. This study is 7 years older, so science has progressed, techniques have progressed, physical therapy has progressed.
But he's also older player, so it's going to take a longer time, yeah.
Yeah. But even with this, I don't believe anybody comes back 100% unless you're like Kevin Durant and you're just a freak of nature.
Sure.
It's not an absolute death sentence to a career anymore, but we will see a significant difference in performance. So for posterity on claims going forward, all Kirk Cousins stats will be viewed from the lens that he will return at 75% health and of performance of previous years if he is ready to go week one.
Okay.
There's really only one person we need to talk about from the Falcons draft, as they spent 5 of their 8 picks on defense. I'm not worried about Jason McClellan or Casey Washington. We're talking about Michael Penix here.
Do it.
So most people's reaction to this draft, including mine, was LeMayo. And mine was, yeah, so this is why this team keeps drafting in the top 10 every year. I thought it was a luxury pick for a team that didn't have the ability to have a luxury pick. In a vacuum, it looks bad, especially given the Kirk Cousins signing, and they ended up only losing a fifth rounder on, which is like a total fleece on the league. I don't know how they just got away with that.
Yeah.
But when you do break it down, this team is retooling and revitalizing their offense on a bunch of rookie contracts to make a push in a more than winnable division.
Yeah.
If this team was on the cusp of playoffs with Desmond Ridder and Arthur Smith, a 75% Kirk Cousins or half a season of Michael Penix is workable to me to make it to the playoffs.
Sure.
I will admit that my takes in the rookie guide were very reactionary. I'll admit it, so we got to dial it back a little bit and be pragmatic about the situation. Penix was my fourth quarterback of this class, but in a vacuum, he ended up on a team that is going to fit his play style extremely well and his strengths. Strong run game, three really good receiving weapons in the tier that he had with Washington with a highly ranked O-line. Some people have them as two, some people have them as five, any kind of where in between, but they definitely are a top 10 offensive line.
Yep.
The question is, when does he start? And that's the biggest conundrum of how this offense is going to operate. Is 75% of Kirk Cousins good enough to win the division and potentially make a deep push? As much as I felt this was a luxury pick on a team that didn't have the ability to make a luxury pick, I don't think it's as bad as I thought once I dug into the numbers and the way the team is constructed, as long as things do go right. In 2 years, Michael will be 27, Kirk will be gone. They'll still have London, Bijan, and rookie deals. It's going to be a game of patience, again, if it goes right.
Do you have any fears? So are you operating under the assumption that Michael Penix will be the week one starter for your Atlanta Falcons?
I will cover that at the end of this.
Okay.
Because I'm going to hit you with a spoiler. I don't really think it matters.
So do you still not think it matters worrying about the transition from a right-handed quarterback to a left-handed quarterback?
I do, but I don't believe the coaching staff is stupid enough to be like, all right, Penix, you're going to play for 2 weeks, and then Kirk, you're going to play, right? Like, it's going to be a significant, I don't want to say significant, I think it's going to take about 3 weeks for that team to acclimate when the offensive switch does happen, right? For, like, them to gel and for them to figure out. But they are definitely, there's no way in camp they're not running both styles of offense.
Sure.
At once, yeah, right? But, they're not going to be like,
yeah, but. But when is Cousins going to get actual, like, practice reps with any of these guys? Dude, is he even before the season or no?
Through Jesus, everything is possible.
I guess so.
He's not full of that vaccine, Ryan, okay? He's good to go.
And Target. He goes to Target a lot, too.
So. Coles, yeah. And Coles. Yeah. See, I don't follow camp stuff, right? I don't really pay attention to, like, off-season news, even though we do this whole off-season setup, because I don't think it's actual news, right? I think it's just hype pieces and shit. So
sure.
I'm assuming he's throwing at some point, right? Like, he's obviously walking around. He's had a surgery, so he's, like, he still has to build up his muscle mass and stuff. But, like... Yeah. It's going to take time to gel, but I think the talent level of this team, you can kind of put out, this is like my spoiler, I think you can kind of put anybody who's not as bad as Desmond Ridder into this team and be successful with the coaching staff that's coming in that I'm going to cover right now.
Sure.
We're going to need to see it from the coaching staff from standpoint to ensure that the prospect of Penix can be valuable asset, and Kirk was the right move for the playoff window of this team, as well as helping the development of Michael Penix. So the Falcons brought in Raheem Morris, who has an extremely long coaching history. I thought he was like a one and done guy, but he's been a coach for forever.
Yeah.
But it is spotty. So he's been a head coach before, twice actually. He has a combined record of 21-38. So it's not stellar on paper, but given context, he was handed the keys to a dumpster fire twice. Once was on the Bucks when Gruden was fired, and once in the Falcons when Dan Quinn was fired. Shout out to the Commanders. Godspeed this season. Tampa Bay is the best sample, as he did turn the team around from a 3-13 team, which he won three with in that season, to a 10-6 team. However, he did go 4-12 the next year. He was also 4-7 on the Falcons on the first go round. So Morris has a long history of Atlanta, where he's basically been every type of coach: defense, wide receiver, quarterbacks coach.
He's a defensive guy, but yes. I wanted to point out that he coached on teams that had Mike Alstott on them. He coached the 2003 Tampa Bay Bucks defense. So him and Mike Alstott shared a team plan.
This podcast is always interconnected.
Let's go.
So Morris was also the defensive coordinator for the Rams in 2021 through 2023, replacing Brandon Staley. So there's two ways this goes, right? He's the Mike McDaniel, D'Amico Ryans type, or he's Brandon Staley. He's going to fly. He's going to bring this team to like the absolute ceiling, or he's going to crash and burn, right? But sure. Brandon Staley did bring viability for fantasy purposes, right? So it's kind of a win-win in our opinion. But there is a vast difference of potential outcomes here for development of players and how things go. So the juice for me here is their offensive coordinator, Zach Robinson, who this is his first year as an offensive coordinator, but he spent the last 5 years in Los Angeles as an assistant quarterback coach, as well as the passing game coordinator. And I think that's a supreme bright side, even if you do kind of like factor in Hall of Famer Matt Stafford being his quarterback, as well as a Hall of Famer Sean McVay being the head coach, right?
Yeah.
So we can point to the success of either or, but he did get the most out of Jared Goff and capitalized on Matt Stafford within a year. So like immediately that team just performed. And he brought both of those quarterbacks to their absolute ceiling. So we're going to do a 5-year breakdown of the way the Rams run their offensive, kind of, I don't want to say do a 1-to-1 of what I expect the Falcons to do, but just like this is, again, like I said, a ceiling play. So this is where we're going to shoot for the ceiling.
Cool.
So the Rams have been back-to-back leaders in 11 personnel at a 91% clip on passing attempts coming with three wide receivers. So if they're throwing the ball, 91% of the time it's three wide receivers, one tight end, one running back, which is great for this team.
Rondale.
No, that's Bijan. So the Rams have thrown at the following league rate since Robinson was involved in the coaching staff: 13th, 23, 10, 15, and 3. The Rams also ranked the following league rate of average yards per attempt: 6, 26, 3, 21, and 13. So they're either really high or they're kind of mid. But league average isn't, there's nothing wrong with being league average. So there are peaks and valleys, and I think within this year, we're going to see ourselves on the lower end due to two non-mobile quarterbacks, new quarterbacks in the system, rookie quarterback, just kind of implementing into the system, right?
Sure.
The offense is going to be Penix's one day, and I think the offense leaning on Bijan initially to take the load off of Kirk on or a rookie quarterback is something I want to bet on. Rookie quarterback-led offenses do lead more towards the running game than the passing game. Bijan's an excellent pass catcher, so dump-offs are going to happen. One wrinkle in that, though, is both Kirk and Penix are gunslingers who are good at processing defenses. So the utilization of 12 personnel in pre-snap motion is still going to be heavily potentially on the table for both players, no matter really who is under center, in my opinion.
Sure.
So last year, league average pass attempts per game was 33.9, and both quarterbacks can do that with ease. Michael Penix's career average is 35 attempts per game, and that comes with a rookie year where he only had 34 attempts on the year total. Kirk had an average of 34.5 attempts per game. Penix's career completion percentage is 63.1 with a yards per attempt of 8.2. Kirk has a career completion of 66.9 with a yards per attempt of 7.6. They're basically the same player, and I think that bodes well for predicting fantasy this year.
Sure.
One is just a known commodity with a major injury, and one is a sixth-year rookie.
Okay.
If we take the average plays per game on the Ram from when Robinson was involved, you would perform that at 63.8 plays per game, which is ironically the exact number that they had last year in 2023, which ranked 14th amount of plays per game in the NFL. Solid okay. Place for, in my opinion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in the last 5 years, the Rams have had an average of 25.88 rush attempts per game, 16th in the league. If we extrapolate those numbers, it would show that 40% of the offense comes from the rushing attack on average with the Rams. If we split that down the middle to accommodate for a rookie quarterback or a 75% Kirk Cousins, that would be roughly 31 rush attempts per game and 31 pass attempts per game on average. However, that would lead the league in rush attempts in the NFL and be 25th in pass attempts.
Right.
So that number doesn't really track when you like look at it objectively. However, I do believe that a Bijan and Tyler Allgeier backing can handle up to 27 touches per game, right? Bijan can have 17 to 20. Tyler Allgeier can have the remaining. More than reasonable in this type of offense or offense. But for the style the offensive team is going to run, I think we're going to see about 26 to 28 attempts per game, which would put them at league average. And even with 18 touches a game for 17 games, that would put Bijan with over 300 touches on the year, which is still wild on a player basis, on even in a reasonable lens for a team.
I also think part of the reason why Rondale was targeted is because he does bring a scat back element to the offense too.
Correct. He's definitely going to be in jet sweeps, and
yeah,
Kyle Pitts and Bijan cannot run out of the slot all the time, right? They're going to have to bring him on. So no, I think he's going to be a nice little wrinkle of who was who was the wide receiver last year who was kind of popping off for the Rams? DeMarcus Robinson?
Sure. Yeah.
Was he running out the slot where was he an outside guy?
He's an outside guy.
Okay. All right. Never mind.
But he got kicked. I think he got kicked in when Kupp got hurt.
Yes.
To start the year. But the start of the year, Tutu was really good.
Yeah. Who was their slot receiver.
Right.
Okay. So yeah, Rondale can be we'll talk wide receivers later. Sure. So brothers, I'm going to say it now. Bijan's the truth and Arthur Smith is a fucking moron. I'm trying to reduce my swearing on this podcast for Mr. Edgecombe, but yeah, Arthur Smith, fucking idiot.
You know what? And with Bijan and Algier, I think that's going to help this whole who's playing quarterback transition in the beginning of the season, because maybe they'll just play clock management and play just try to run the shit out of the ball and at least help Phoenix so it doesn't have to throw a lot and make that transition for when Cousins decides to come back. Not when he decides, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, and they also, like I said, they beefed up their defense, right? So if they're kind of just going to play bully ball and just let the quarterback maintain the game and put them in a position to win.
But like, honestly, man, like, if you're Raheem Morris and you get hired to this team and you're a defensive guy and they pass on defensive player of your choice for 26-year-old Michael Penix, like, you got to be a little butthurt. Just a little bit.
Especially when you watch like the Texans do it, right? But again, the Falcons didn't have the luxury of having another first round pick this year.
It's true.
So
it's
they definitely didn't have the play to do so. I think they're going to be, I keep using the word or the term 75%. I think they're going to be 75% of the Texans, right? It's going to be like the Wish version.
Hey man, in that division.
Yeah. I don't know, dude, you played Derek Carr, Baker Mayfield and Bryce Young twice a year. It's exploitable, right? They're not elite. They're not elite guys, but like, they are dudes who can be taken advantage of. So last year, the Falcons had a 30.3 rush attempts per game, and Bijan was ranked 31st at the position of opportunity share, even though he ranked 9th in snap share at the position. He ranked 19th in carries, 3rd in targets, and 32nd on red zone attempts. Absolute criminal shit.
Garbage.
Bijan's expected points added was atrocious because Arthur Smith didn't know how to run an offense as he believed in Desmond Ridder. For his efficiency metrics, Bijan ranked 5th in yards created, 11th in juke rate, 7th in evaded tackles. He was on elite on a team that saw one of the lowest average defenders in the box. If Smith would have pulled his head out of his ass, Bijan would have absolutely torched on the ground.
Yep.
And again, like, this is the benefit of having so many good wide receivers and three wide receiver sets and motion is the boxes are going to be light yet again.
Yes. Probably even better.
Yeah. Luckily, Bijan did see a huge target share because Desmond Ridder couldn't throw farther than 2 yards. So he had a 17.2% target share, which is like wide receiver 2 numbers, wide receiver 3 numbers on target shares. He was first in routes run at the position of 385 routes run. 8.4 yards per reception with 86 targets. That's like CMC levels of efficiency and like target value. So now this is an issue because the Rams do have historically not targeted the running back in the room post Todd Gurley, but this is a little different in my opinion. So I don't want to be like, hey, he's going to get 150 targets, but like talent does, if you have an intelligent offensive coordinator, they will utilize their skill sets of like, hey, instead of throwing 60 targets to the running back room, we'll bump it up to 80, right? So I do believe honestly that Bijan is the best weapon on this team. If Bijan sees 18 touches per game, that's 300 touches a year, and if we infer the loss of a rushing quarterback with statue QBs, the target share should remain the same, if not go up a little bit through checkdowns and game script.
Yeah. I'm big. Kirk Cousins was like 5th in checkdown rate last year, so just saying.
With Alexander Mattison and Ty Chandler, right?
Uh-huh. So, yep. Yes, sir.
Can Bijan get 100 targets? It's in his range of outcomes. I'd say it's slim, but 80 plus, I'd probably take the over. Or 80, I'd probably take the over, like 80.5, right? And those are the kind of numbers we want to chase at the position. So there's absolutely no way Bijan is going to see 31 red zone touches this year. The ball is going to be pushed down the middle of the field. It is at a much more efficient rate than last year. So there will be premier goal line. He will be the premier goal line back given his skill ceiling. Granted, Tyler Allgeier still is going to vulture 4 to 6 touchdowns on the year because I think this offense is just going to score a lot. Yep. And we're going to watch Twitter rage over that fact. But Bijan has scored more than 8 touchdowns this year. Scoring more than 8 touchdowns this year, especially with the presumed 75% snap share and 18% target share on checkdowns. So per 4 for 4, Bijan is running back 2 and pick 7 overall. So boys, Bijan or Breece Hall?
Breece.
Okay.
Bijan's my RB3.
Okay. Bijan or Amon-Ra St. Brown?
Oh, damn.
Bijan.
I'm gonna go with Shane's narrative that Bijan's gonna be, you know, they're gonna utilize him how he should be, and I'm gonna go Bijan.
I'm gonna go Bijan because, and this goes back to a debate we've been having in the Discord. When someone says I'm using a hero RB draft style, to me that means you're picking one of the first 3 running backs. If I draft Bijan at pick 5, right, or 6, whatever it is. Then I'm going next round, you know, Brandon Ayuk, Chris Olave, Nico Collins. And then the round after that, I'm going Jalen Waddle, T. Higgins, George Pickens, whatever, whoever's there. Like,
or Derrick Henry, right? Like, you just right. Double up on running back and call it a day.
Right. And so, like, if I'm drafting Bijan, CMC, or Breece Hall, I'm not drafting a running back for 4 more rounds, period.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the thing is, too, right, like how many bell cow running backs are left in the NFL? 5, maybe?
Yeah, right.
Right? So, like, if you're not taking a shot on someone like this, you're just completely, like, just going 0 RB, in my opinion, right? Like, sure. if you're not gonna play, like you said, like, hero RB, I'm not getting, like, the first 3 dudes off the rip. You're just saying, you know what, dude, you can play that game. I'll pick my value somewhere else.
Right.
So I know this is a pro Tyler Allgeier podcast and he's fun as hell to root for, but I think we finally see the keys of the kingdom being handed over. He's a great rotational piece. He's great for 600 yards on the year, 15 receptions and around 4 to 6 touchdowns, like I mentioned earlier. So unless like the Falcons call an absolute terror offensively, where he's the handcuff for his high points per game due to touchdown weeks. And even then he only topped off as running back 13th. He's a 12th rounder, and I like him better than most of the receiving weapons outside of Hawk and Wandell there. I'd take a QB in this tier like Kirk, Stafford, over Allgeier.
Can I ask you an either-or for this one?
Yes.
Would you rather have Tyler Allgeier or Antonio Gibson?
I want Tyler Allgeier.
Ryan?
Yeah, I like the one, too. Yeah, I'll have to go Allgeier.
They're just going to score more.
would you take right. Allgeier over Chuba Hubbard?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's tricky because, like, I think Chuba's going to get, like, 6 weeks of gamesmanship, right? Like, I think Chuba's definitely going to be a smokescreen on the year. I know I covered him a couple weeks ago, but I think, like, the first month to 6 weeks of Chuba's definitely going to people be like, Jonathan Brooks sucks for not using him. Chuba's a better running back, right?
Sure.
Just based on, like, target volume and, like...
He'll get the keys.
Yeah. Exactly. So... I looked at the last 5 years of the Rams' offense to determine the target share of what we would see across all positions, and what I've seen is the following. Matt Stafford loves to sling that ball. Jared Goff loves touchdowns, and the Rams hate checking it down to running backs.
Sure.
So in the sample size of those 5 years, the target share breaks down as follows. 67% to the wide receiver, 12% to the running back, and 21% to the tight end. Really? Massive disparity of that value I gave you of 18% for Bijan to 12% on the Rams.
Yep.
But it's a bright side on the others, and I did some more napkin math to predict roughly 31 pass attempts per game, so that gives us about 530 targets on the year. That would break down within those percentages of 355 targets to wide receivers, 64 targets to the running back room, 111 targets from the tight ends. Granted, those numbers are obviously going to slide around a little bit more just to pad Bijan, not because I want it to happen, but because he's a talent and that's targets go to who deserves them. He's a great route runner. Another Crisco stat, there's only been 8 quarterbacks in the last decade who have 2 wide receivers finishing top 12. Stroud, Tua, Russ, the big rapist, Stafford, Breeze, Manning, and Rodgers. I don't believe Kirk or Penix can really do that, especially given the threshold of talent on this team. I want to call London the wide receiver one and Pitts the wide receiver two, and then Mooney and Moore is more like receiving options 4 and 5 potentially, right? Especially
okay.
in like,
okay.
and or it'll bump them up in 11 personnel packages. I'm not going to lie. I'm going to whip it out right now because I am Drake London pilled this year.
Yeah.
So Drake London
that's
is
two of us.
Dude, I did like an hour of research and I was like, I'm so mad. I sold all my shares in Dynasty. I'm an idiot. So Drake London is going to operate as the true X, as he can be moved around in the field per Matt Harmon of Reception Perception. He saw a 9% increase slot snaps with a 72% success rate against man, 82% against zone, and 77% against press. Dude can win at all three levels of the game and is going to be used in space and is going to be used as the same type of route tree that we saw with Puka, with outs, digs, and daggers. We're going to see a breakout, and I'm really mad. Like I said earlier, I didn't keep any of my shares for Dynasty. So for the last 2 years, Drake London has topped at 100 targets with a 23% target share. But I think that's going to go up plain and simple, right? Will it be 30%? No, but I think like 25 to 27% target share, especially with the volume on this team, is absolutely within his range of outcomes. This isn't slander to Mooney or Rondale, but this is his room and talent is prioritized, like I said earlier. This is honestly an easy 1,000-yard season for London, and I'd be willing to bet it's more on the cusp of 1,500 yards with an increased rate of touchdowns. We're going to see a top 10 target rate with at least 9 targets per game, in my opinion. 130 targets minimum. I'm calling it now.
I was reading the reception perception stuff, and I was reading about the offense and all that kind of stuff. And then I did some looking all over the place. They call it research.
Getting really high and reading articles. Yeah,
I do too. So I posted a pic in the general chat right now of the dagger route. And the dagger route is I'm renaming the Puka route because that's how Puka Nacua got like 90% of his receiving yards last year.
And like 160 targets.
Yeah. Ryan, are you looking at that image right there?
Yeah, I looked at it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a yellow box right there where the money zone is for where the quarterback needs to put the ball. And guess which quarterback had the highest PFF grade for throws in that direct spot in the center of the field?
Kirk Cousins.
There it is.
I mean, that's like the Hawk and Justin Jefferson spot, right? Right in the middle of the field, they take off, right? That's 25 yards easy every time.
Yep.
Yeah, because you pull the corners and safeties following those two guys going hot route, and then you got the tight end splitting right, and then the other guy cutting in right when those guys get passed on the hot route. Yeah.
Well, the reason why it's such a dangerous route is because it beats man and zone. If that running back that has that option route to either go to the right or the left to pull the linebackers is going to be Bijan fucking Robinson. So he's going to get the attention of those linebackers.
And fucking Kyle Pitts, right? Like,
right.
You have like this massive actual like fantasy brain. It's finally going to pay off offense, right? If like there's so many people they have to cover and then the O-line's good. He's going to have time to throw, right? They're going to have to put people in coverage, right? So it's going to be nice. Like I'm so Falcons filled. It's like embarrassing. So I will say Drake London, pricey as hell. Per 4 for 4, he's pick 202 overall, right behind Marv, right ahead of Jonathan Taylor, Olave, Ayuk, and Adams.
He's been going ahead. He's been going at the end of the first in the drafts I've been doing.
Yeah, they're all TH Fantasy listeners.
Yeah, I hope so.
So this is going to be a pick that wins people leagues or costs in the league, depending on, like I said, range of outcomes. Either it's going to be great or it's going to be embarrassing. And we're playing the ceiling, so give me Drake London at this spot every time.
Yep. Would you take Drake London or Nico Collins?
I think you could get both. Right? Like, I think like the way ADP breaks down, I've been saying it all offseason. I think the fact that Stephon Diggs showed up in Houston really push down the people we want to draft in the drafts, right? So I think you can get at the turn, you can get Nico Collins again.
Are you comfortable drafting Drake London 111?
Yeah, who else am I going to draft? Right?
JT?
I like Jonathan Taylor, but I don't think like on that offense, like unless defenses cannot figure out how to operate with Anthony Richardson, I don't think he finishes super high, right?
What about, would you guys take Drake London over Saquon?
Probably.
Wow. All right. I love this. This is great. Keep it going, Shane. Let's go.
I mean, we'll cover the Eagles at a later date, but I still, like, I don't know. Like, I was pretty much on the money of where those targets went last year, right? Of like, hey, the threshold for targets on that team was like 80 for the year. And guess how many targets Swift saw? Like 75.
Sure.
Right. So his ceiling's capped. I don't know. Whatever. We'll talk about that later. So Mooney is in the best possible combination of quarterbacks he's ever played with. I'm sorry, guys, but it's the truth.
It's the truth.
How dare you diss Darnell Mooney?
Well, he's breaking down my door right now. I do view him as the field stretcher. On average, he's seen 90 targets across his career per year. That number is inflated as he was the wide receiver one in 2021 and saw 120 targets. I still think with the volume of passing on this team that this range of outcomes is about 80 targets on the year. He's going to be frustrating, but he's a better best ball player. He's going to catch some sick ass bombs for either one of these quarterbacks, and it's going to win people weeks. He's going to have a 20-point week, and people are going to go sicko mode on Fab after that fact. He's free in the 13th rounder, so why not as your last pick in the draft? Whatever, unless you punt it on quarterback or defense or whatever. You don't want to take Hawk. So we love Rondale. Short Kings, rise up.
Let's go.
But like I said, he's the fourth or fifth option on this team. He's the slot dude. I can see him getting about 50 to 60 targets on the year, but that's not really fantasy viable unless you're playing like touchdown dependency stuff, right? Because like, I mean, he might be great in golf, right? He's going to burn you 1 or 2 weeks, but like he's going to get one or two targets of the year. He'd do a jet sweep. So he'll get you like 7 points.
Yeah. Rondale and Mooney, I think in this offense are just better real life players than fantasy assets.
Correct. And that benefits the other weapons for fantasy, right? It's like they're actually good players who can open the field. Like you're talking about of the dagger concept of there's so many options for the defense to cover. Like, what are they going to do?
Right.
All right. So on to wide receiver two, Kyle Pitts. This actually might be the year we do see the year one breakout repeat. I know it's been like 3 years since that point, but he was third highest in slot snaps for the position, first in air yard share at the position, first in average depth per target, first in deep targets, but it's where it falls off of 19% target share, 37th in target accuracy, and 34th in red zone targets.
Yikes. Can we please just get a decent Kyle Pitts here this year?
We're going to.
So now that all the negative stuff's out the window, he's the true slot guy in this 11 personnel package. If Tyler Higbee can consecutively see 90 targets on the Rams, there's absolutely no way that Kyle Pitts does not get 100 targets on the year. There's no one else on this offense to compete with in 11 personnel targets for those 111 targets. Obviously, the value might be a little depressed because of Bijan or whatever. I think we've heard this narrative for 4 years on Kyle Pitts now where I don't want to drone on and on. We know he's that dude, but I think I'm finally Pitts-pilled. He's a fifth rounder where the only person in this round I'm taking over him is Anthony Richardson. The fifth round consists of Chris Godwin, James Cook, Calvin Ridley, Jaden Reed, Keenan Allen, Dalton Kincaid, Jacobs, Hollywood, Mandrews, and Mahomes. Granted, we're playing ceiling here again. I think Mandrews might be honestly the correct play given his price for the floor output that we're going to see. But I'm trying to win, so I'm going high. Right, play forward eighth round if you're not in tight end premium.
I have a lot of Mark Andrews stuff when we get there for the Ravens episode, and you guys, I gotta get real close.
Tight end one.
I got a lot of Chris Godwin shit.
Oh yeah,
he's going to the slot. He's going to get 120 targets this year, right?
Chris Godwin might be a league winner this year.
Let's go, baby. So we'll debate that in the fifth round when we get to the segment. All right. So now that here's the real question I've talked about the whole time. What the hell are we doing with quarterback? I've given you VLS data, all this hype on players, and it all hinges on quarterback, right? Kirk or Penix. I'm going to be honest with you guys. Like I said earlier, I don't really think it matters. I think what matters is how you construct your team. If you have the ability to do so with a bench space or IR spot, I'm drafting either of these guys, and then another quarterback is like the guy I'm going to lead with. Take Dak in the 8th, Love in the 9th, Purdy in the 10th. Kirk is the biggest risk in the 13th, and Penix is free, as he's not even listed on 4 for 4 ADP, so I think he'll be a waiver wire until they announce Kirk isn't starting the first game. So in conclusion, I'm jorking it. My Penix.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm super high on this team. I'm going to ride or die with this team. So if y'all ride with me, I'm sorry if it sinks, but if at the end of the day I can victory lap every one of these players, I'm going to tell you I told you so. I'm just way more optimistic on this 2 years because of the unknown, ironically enough. I know it sucks to be like, I want the mystery bag, but I'm going to take the mystery bag over Arthur Smith and Desmond Ridder and Marcus Mariota, right?
Well, it's, to me, it's less the mystery bag and more the fact that, like, they were held back by a coach that's not there anymore and a quarterback that's not there anymore. So what's there to lose? I mean, one of the things that jumped out to me was how absolutely bad Drake London, Kyle Pitts, and Darnell Mooney's catchable target rates were last year.
2 years in a row, right?
Like... Right, right. Well, like, I was even looking at Mooney. Mooney's 2022 catchable target rate was 93rd in the league. And then in 2023, his catchable target rate was 99th in the league. His true
I'm sorry, guys.
Dude, his true catch rates, Mooney in 2022 and 2023, were 6th and 5th. Like, they are good receivers that were trapped.
Yeah.
I think London explosion is totally doable. I'm all for it. I'm worried about Penix coming in because he's a lefty, but I'm just probably overthinking it.
No, it's honestly a valid concern, dude. Like, it is a much more significant thing than people want to admit, myself included, right? But, like, I'm also not, granted, we are smarter than some NFL coaches, but we're also dumber than a lot of NFL coaches, right? There's no way that this team is not preparing for both coin flips, right? Right? They took the dude at 8, not just to sit, right? They knew there was some reason why they had to take this player.
Sure.
So
that makes sense.
I don't know, man. Maybe they're just a bunch of dumbasses and I'm completely a snake oil salesman at this point, right? So I don't know. But again, it's fantasy. I'm playing for the ceiling going forward from now on. I don't care about floor. It's one more year. If we lose, we lose. Who gives a shit? Playing a bunch of leagues. It doesn't matter. Diversify your options.
11 out of 12 people lose in every league anyways.
Yep.
So
I think Atlanta's going to be real fun to watch.
Oh, we got to look at their schedule too. Sorry.
Yeah, let's do a schedule breakdown.
This is my new bit. Last year, I couldn't remember what team I was going to pick. This year, I can't ever look at the schedule.
Right. Shane forgets the schedule.
All right. First game, okay. Steelers.
Ooh.
I had that as a loss when we did Pittsburgh, so I'm going to keep
it. Yeah, that's right.
I think it's okay. A loss. Yeah. The Eagles.
Loss.
Yeah, I'm saying loss, yeah.
Chiefs.
Damn, 0-3 start. Let's go.
Not a good look for Raheem Morris. All right, Saints.
Easy.
I'll call it a win. I had the Saints splitting, I think. So that's I'll fair. Call it a win.
Exercising those demons out on Derek Carr.
All right, Bucks.
Dub.
Sure. I had them splitting against the Bucks.
Falcons.
They are the Falcons.
Sorry, I do this every time. Panthers.
That's a win.
Yeah.
Okay.
Seahawks.
It's a win.
In Seattle or?
In Atlanta.
Okay, I'll call it a win.
Buccaneers.
Damn, they're on a roll.
I have them splitting, so I'll call it a loss.
Cowboys.
Loss.
L City.
They go to the Saints.
Splitting again, so I'll call that a win.
I'll give that a loss.
Broncos.
Easy dub.
Sure.
Chargers.
Ooh, that'll be a tight game. In LA or?
In Atlanta.
In it's Atlanta.
A it's a win for me, dog.
It a loss.
I think our secondary's too bad to cover Drake London. This is when Drake London goes nuclear, right? 30 points in fantasy, 2 touchdowns, 150 yards.
Hell yeah.
Then they go to Minnesota.
Dub.
Win.
Okay, then they go to Vegas to play the Raiders.
Another win. Holy shit.
They go to the Giants.
Easy win.
Win.
Commanders.
Oh my God.
Win. What? I have them at 10. How is this happening?
Okay, last game of the season. Panthers.
Oh my God. Atlanta's going to win 11 games this year? Is this real?
I'm going to put that down as an L because I believe they'll have the division locked up by then.
11 wins. So, wait, Tony, have you looked up the FanDuel's over and unders for wins yet?
No.
There's no way it can be 10.5. I bet you it's 9.5 or 8.5 probably.
Yeah, you might want to hang some money on that. I got him 11-6. Wow.
Yeah, I have him a lot of them ones too. Interesting.
That's crazy.
Are those holy up? Shit. Are those props up yet?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In some places, yeah.
Yeah, we should put money on that. Yeah, that's the Falcons, baby.
That's pretty good. I'm not gonna lie. Got me excited.
I tried to overturn every stone possible. Nothing was gonna be missed.
That's great. All right. Yeah. So we'll take a quick break. We're gonna come back. We got the Titans and the Bucks. So we'll see you on episode 139.5. And goodbye.
Up so much he just folded in half and spilled all over his shirt.